Hi everyone, thank you so much for coming today. Hope you're all doing well. I'm going to be doing the sermon today, and I actually just wanted to start with a quick game. It's a bit like heads down, thumbs up, but instead of heads down, we're going to shut your eyes. And instead of your thumbs up, it would just be hands up. So really it's eyes shut, hands up. So if you can all shut your eyes, please, and I'm going to ask you three questions. So the first question is, hands up if you feel optimistic about the state of the world. Ooh. Okay, some last minute additions. Okay, hands down. Hands up if you can see the good in Donald Trump. Okay, a unanimous room. And hands up, the last one is, hands up if you find it easy to have a positive self-image. So to see the good in yourself. Okay. Nice, thank you. Okay, so hands down, eyes open again. So this sermon looks at a section of 1 Corinthians 13, a chapter which outlines all the ways in which love can be characterised. Specifically, we will look at the verse, love always looks for the best. So first, I think it's important to place this verse in its context. I also think the beginning of this passage, so this is the passage we're focusing on today, but I think the beginning bit that precedes this is also really beautiful, so I want to look at that as well. So this is how chapter 1, Corinthians 13 begins. If I speak with human eloquence and angelic ecstasy but don't love, I'm nothing but the creaking of a rusty gate. If I speak God's word with power, revealing all his mysteries and making everything plain as day, and I have faith that says to a mountain, jump, and it jumps, but I don't love, I'm nothing. If I give everything I own to the poor and even go to the stake to be burned as a martyr, but I don't love, I've got nowhere. So no matter what I say, what I believe, and what I do, I'm bankrupt without love. So this passage seems to significantly demarcate love away from other characteristics. Love is not intelligence, it is not happiness, it is not spirituality, it is not deep faith, it is not sacrifice, it is not grace. Love is an entity of its own and one that is essential to our being. Eric Fromm, a psychologist and philosopher, puts this as, love is the only sane and satisfactory answer to the problem of human existence. So love always looks for the best, speaks to an inner layer of love where hope and optimism are driving forces. It suggests a constant reorientation towards a positive outlook and a commitment to always look for the best outcome. We'll explore this in three parts today. We were looking at the best in ourselves, looking for the best in others, and finally, looking for the best in our world. So, love always looks for the best in ourselves. If we look for immediate, measurable outcomes as the result of looking for the best in ourselves, the results are clear. We don't have to stray far. There's loads of research on this. So studies conducted in 2020 on supportive care in cancer suggest that increasing hope can improve symptoms and daily functioning in those with chronic illness, whilst other work has found hope to be a protective factor against post-traumatic stress disorder, so PTSD. Optimism is related to fewer symptoms of depression, higher levels of well-being, and stronger perceptions of social support. More evidence reveals that optimism is associated with better cardiovascular health and increased likelihood of healthy aging. In contrast, pessimists are more likely to adopt risky behaviours, such as the use and abuse of alcohol and other drugs, and display more harmful reactions and adaptations to adversities. As a catalyst for positive change, hope promotes overall mental health and may help heal specific conditions, including severe mental illness, suicidal ideation, depression, anxiety, and trauma-related disorders. But love isn't just this. The Bible teaches us that to love and to be loved is a spiritual transformation. We don't just love for better health outcomes. So is this all that there is to it? I found this section on looking for the best in ourselves the hardest to write. Beyond exploring research that displays the personal benefits and life outcomes of hope and optimism, I found delving into passages around self-love to feel indulgent and uncomfortable. And I wonder what that says. Bell Hooks, in her book titled All About Love, reflects on why this might be. And this is the passage just up here. Taught to believe that the mind, not the heart, is the seat of learning, many of us believe that to speak of love without any emotional intensity means we will be perceived as weak and irrational. And it's especially hard to speak of love when what we have to say calls attention to the fact that lovelessness is more common than love, that many of us are not sure what we mean when we talk of love or how to express love. I wonder if that's a shared experience, viewing self-love and self-belief as weak or irrational or maybe a vulnerable thing to admit. And moreover, I wonder if a lack of love and receiving love has rendered us to feel uncomfortable when directing love towards ourselves. Yet the Bible repeatedly demonstrates to us that God looks for the best in us and has always done so, whilst being all-knowing of our flaws and our failures. I never tire of these two verses. One of them is Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. And the second one is Psalm 139:13-14. For you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. Finally, looking for the best in ourselves is a fundamental attribute to love because it is what God has done for us. 1 John 4:19 says this, love is a fundamental part of his nature. We are only able to love him or anyone else because he first loved us. We are only able to freely give to others what we have freely received from him. Therefore, looking for the best in ourselves and having an attitude of hope and optimism towards self is a fundamental act of love and a godly instruction. Now, we'll turn to love always looks for the best in others. So if love always looks for the best, then how do we love others? The premise of Christianity and biblical teaching is pretty straightforward. If God loves us boundlessly, then we have been set free to lay down our subtle suspicions, our default distrust, and to assume the best in others. But how easy is this to do? Shakespeare's character, King Lear, famously said, I am a man more sinned against than sinning. This is something I think we can all be guilty of, seeing other person's actions as problematic and directed towards us, and therefore our responsibility to restore justice and righteousness. And when this is our focus, we are quick to speak and slow to listen. We are quick to write off and slow to bear with. We are quick to suspect and we are slow to forgive. But that spirit is set directly against the spirit of love. 1 Corinthians 13, the chapter this series focuses on, is renowned and memorable for the more traditional version of describing love as the following. Love is patient, love is kind, love does not envy or boast, it is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way, it is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. A lesser well-known translation recites this verse slightly differently and I think highlights other aspects that really looks at how we love others. And this is the one up here. Christian love is empowered and equipped to be different in the family, the church and the world. When suspicion chokes out laughter and distrust destroys friendships, the people of God ought to glow in our cynical world, bearing all things, hoping all things, believing all things. In a collection titled Letters to My Students, Charles Spurgeon, an English Particular Baptist preacher, writes, it would be better to be deceived 100 times than to live a life of suspicion. So Spurgeon's view is a direct opposite to what King Lear suggests. Actually, that there's a freedom in forbearance, a freedom in forgiveness, and a freedom in optimism towards others. The article I found Charles Spurgeon's quote from summarises reflection as, more often than not, it is better to look the possible racism and possible sexism and possible insensitivity. And that's where I slightly stumbled on this article I found this quote from. And I think we should look at this tangent. So what do we do with this dilemma? We're instructed that love always looks for the best. And love always looks for the best in others, and that Christian love is empowered and equipped to be different. But do we look for the best when we are confronted, either directly or indirectly, with racism, sexism, or homophobia? Do we look for the best in the CEOs of companies who have decimated the resources and populations of countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo? Do we look for the best in the recent rioters in Belfast who have caused children to flee their homes and schools for fear of violence? Bell Hooks writes this in relation to love and activism. Refusal to stand up for what you believe in weakens individual morality and ethics as well as those of the culture. No wonder then that we are a nation of people who claim to believe in the divine power of love and yet collectively remain unable to embrace a love ethic and allow it to guide behaviour, especially if doing so would mean supporting radical change. This thereby suggests that the most loving thing to do is not to refuse to stand up for what you believe in under the guise of looking for the best in others. But this is complicated in itself. So Bell Hooks is a really renowned writer and philosopher and thinker, and she's often credited in a lot of sermons that do here, which I credit her throughout this sermon. But interestingly, she is also remembered as an ardent critic of the Central Park Five. So the Central Park Five case refers to the arrests of five black and Latino teenage boys in 1989 who were wrongly imprisoned for up to 13 years for an attack against a woman. They were only proven to be innocent in 2002, and the case became a prominent example of racial profiling, discrimination, and inequality in the legal system and the media. The teenage boys were essentially forced to confess to a crime they didn't commit. And Bell Hooks at the time made repeated cruel and racially driven commentary regarding the teenager's innocence. So what do we do when the philosophers who point us towards radical change and activism don't do it in the ways that we needed them to throughout history? So this is potentially a prime example, I think, of how there's no clear line to draw of how isms should be addressed when we are expected to look for the best in others, but also to stand up for those who face injustice. The compromise I can suggest is that overlooking an offence and forbearance and forgiveness must not be confused with submitting to morally and ethically unacceptable circumstances. So Brené Brown, in one of her articles on anger, shares an interesting reflection which I think fits here and is the best solution I can find to this dilemma. And it's, anger is a soul-sucking lifetime companion, but it's also a great catalyst for two of the grittiest, truest forms of love, justice and equity. Without love as a driving force, rage does not fuel action or serve as a catalyst, but simply kills hope and resolve. Love is necessary for anger to become fruitful in guiding behaviour and radical change. So looking for the best in others is not a weak alternative to standing up against injustice. Looking for the best in others allows us to glow in a cynical world and to not give in to scepticism and suspicion. So finally, how does love look for the best in our world? Bell Hooks writes this: everywhere we learn that love is important, and yet we are bombarded by its failure. In the realm of the political, among the religious, in our families, in our romantic lives, we see little indication that love informs decisions, strengthens our understanding of community, or keeps us together. This bleak picture in no way alters the nature of our belonging. We still hope that love will prevail. A very memorable conversation between Elizabeth Oldfield, who wrote a book called Fully Alive, who I would recommend to anyone who wants to look at being a Christian in the modern world, and Dr. Gwen Adshead has stuck in my mind for a really long time and is actually what prompted me to pick this topic when Mike put the verse out originally. And they were having a discussion around the purpose of empathy and optimism in a failing world. So Dr. Gwen Adshead is a psychiatrist and psychotherapist who works with people who we would deem evil. These are rapists, murderers, paedophiles, people who have been convicted of the most taboo crimes that we struggle to ever reconcile how a human can enact them and can cause them. And discussing whether we can have empathy in the face of evil, Dr. Gwen Adshead shares this. I think what sustains me is a belief in the goodness and order of the universe, that goodness exists as much as evil does. And that is something we absolutely have to hold on to. And it is a duty to be hopeful, to have faith, have hope and love. These three are duties. They're not simply a lovely ornament on life. They're a duty and a way of relating to the world. 2024 research into hope and optimism shows how hope acts as an antidote to fear, apathy and nihilism, describing hope not as a denial of what is, but a belief that the current situation is not the end. This study pointed out two really important characteristics of hope. One, that hope is active and not a passive entity. Chan Hellman, the lead of the Hope Research Centre, found that hope is about taking action towards a better future or outcome. Secondly, that collective hope, according to Hellman, involves combining energies to cast a shared vision of the future and identifying strategies to achieve goals. Big societal issues can feel overwhelming because alone we can't move the needle, he said. But when we find others, who share our story or experience, we collectively form a powerful voice and energy that can influence change. So let's explore both those points a little bit more. The fact that hope and looking for the best demands action to follow suggests that then this might be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If hope prompts action, does action further create hope? Omid Shabani does a lot of research on the optimism bias, whereby an optimistic outlook influences the outcome in a situation. Evidence of this bias in situations such as marriages or work suggests that by looking for the best, we influence our attitudes and our perspectives towards challenges we face and thereby change our subjective reality. The way we expect the world to be changes the way we see it. What happens when that occurs on a collective scale? Collective efficacy refers to how the belief that joint efforts will make a difference inspires a stronger commitment to things such as protests, involvement and mobilisation, resulting in an improved outcome for a cause. So hope can be experienced in an uncertain world, in both safe and dire circumstances. Hope is self-fulfilling and most powerful when experienced on a collective scale. Looking for the best, as Dr. Gwen Adshead said, is not simply a lovely ornament on life, but a duty towards our faith and towards the world. So just to finish up, love always looks for the best in ourselves, in others, and in the world and the future it holds. This is not automatically in our nature, nor is this simple to enact or easy to maintain. But the other option is lovelessness, to let fear and contempt and self-righteousness to govern us and to navigate hard news and hard people. Love has to look for the best in ourselves, in others, in the world. If we don't love, we can't access hope and possibility. And if we don't action hope and optimism, we can't love. And that is the end of what I have to say. Thank you.